So I realize many of you are still eating, so please do continue, but we want to start with our program. You know, we work very hard as a group to bring really top-notch speakers to the Forum Club, and I don't know that anybody works any harder on the program committee than Bill Strong. So it is again my pleasure to introduce him for the 18th time. Just kidding, Bill. But for those of you that don't know Bill, he's a proud Hoosier, a graduate of Purdue, and then a graduate of the Kellogg School at Northwestern University. Had a fabulous career in investment banking at two different firms, Salomon Brothers, and also at Morgan Stanley, culminating in his role as chairman of their Asian operations and a vice chairman of the firm. He's very involved. For those of you that have any touch points with Navy SEALs, he is very involved in that. And he's the kind of guy with his wife and three kids, one of whom lives down here, that believes strongly in making the community a better place. And he works very hard on behalf of the Forum Club. So here to introduce our host, Bill Strong. Sorry, our guest.
Yeah, thanks a lot, thank you. Very kind words. We're obviously delighted that Carl Rove could join us today. This is our 38th season, by the way, for the Forum Club. Carl, thanks for joining us. I know you've got 1,000 requests. You're nice to be here. Carl Rove has been successful in each of his careers. As we all know, he's arguably the leading political strategist and tactician of our generation. He's a highly regarded contributor to Fox News, as Ed mentioned, and he writes a widely read weekly op-ed for the Wall Street Journal. And he has written two highly successful books. His autobiography, Courage and Consequence, which was a New York Times bestseller, as well as The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. As Ed said, everyone in this room knows Karl Rove. But how did Karl Rove get to be Karl Rove? Let's start in 1965 in Salt Lake City, where Carl was attending high school. A teacher encouraged him to run for the class senate. As part of his campaign strategy, he rode in the back of a convertible inside the school gymnasium, sitting between two very attractive girls. This is right before his election speech. Carl won that election. Carl, very clever man, very clever. Now let's fast forward to 1973. And Carl is attending George Mason University. Having increasingly been involved in political activities, Carl decided to seek the position of the national chairman for college Republicans, which as you all know is a really big deal. He campaigned for the job all over the country, driving a Ford Pinto. The campaign was exceptionally hard fought, if you've read the details of it. He was informed that he had won that election by the then chairman of the Republican National Committee, George H.W. Bush. Thus began a lifelong relationship between Carl and the Bush family. In subsequent years, Carl worked on hundreds of successful campaigns, developing a reputation as a skilled tactician as well as fundraiser. Carl was then asked by George W. Bush to serve as his chief political strategist for Bush's 2000 presidential bid. As we know, especially well here in Florida, Carl and Governor Bush were successful in that campaign. I met Carl in April of 2004. I asked him how the 2004 re-election campaign would play out. Carl stated at that time, again, April of 2004, he said, "Bill, it's all about Ohio. In fact, two specific counties in Ohio." Again, April of 04. He said that by Election Day 2004, we would know the undecided voters in those two counties by name. He was right about Ohio, and President Bush was reelected. You may remember November of 2004, just after the election, President Bush famously called Carl the architect of his 2004 victory. During both Bush administrations, Carl served in senior posts in the White House, as we all know, and he left the White House in 2007. Since 2007, we've seen Carl on Fox News and many other programs, and as I mentioned, you've probably seen as many op-eds in the Wall Street Journal. Just last week in the journal, Carl reviewed the success rate of the predictions he had made for 2022. He was right 74% of the time. What did he get right? Among other things, he predicted that the Republicans would retake the House with fewer seats than the post-World War II average. No red wave. He was right. He predicted that inflation would rise faster than wages. This is the one that gets me. He also predicted that Mike Tirico would replace Al Michaels on Sunday Night Football. How does he know that? I don't get that. What was one of his incorrect predictions? That Brazil, not Argentina, would win the World Cup. Now he's made predictions for 2023. What is he predicting for 2023? Republican presidential candidates will number no more than 6 by the end of this year, which is a lot less than the 17 we had at the end of 2015. The U.S. debt ceiling gets raised, but it's going to be really ugly getting that debt ceiling raised. And lastly, he stated that Nancy Pelosi is going to leave Congress. Please welcome Karl Rove.
Thank you, Bill. Actually, he left out the most important prediction I had for 2022, which I did not include in my 2022 calculations of 74%, and that was I forecast in December of 2021 that by the end of January I'd have a new dog and his name would be Doc Holliday. Anyway, Bill, thank you for the overly generous and kind introduction, and President Liddy, great to see you again. I'm sort of surprised Liddy wasn't, he was pleasant to me at lunch. I say that because I was part of the crew that said, we need to get somebody to take over AIG. Why don't we go get Liddy? And he got talked into it by Bernanke and Paulson and Bush, but to take on a terrible task at a critical moment for our country. And thank you for doing that. And my man Rooney is here. Rooney built the stadium that allowed George W. Bush to make a bunch of money when he sold the Rangers. And so if you don't like Bush's presidency, blame it on Rooney. There is, however, this is an elite group, I can tell. But even among this elite group, you have scoundrels. There is a gambler in this room. I'm talking, of course, about Jerry Whitburn, who insists upon betting with me on every Green Bay Packers Cowboys game. I'm not a fan of the Cowboys, but Whitburn says I have to bet for him because it's territorial loyalty. So anyway, Whitburn takes me for $50 every time his Green Bay Packers beat somebody else's Dallas Cowboys. Anyway, I was also honored to be here with our student guest today. I know where I'm going if I want to have a robotic instrument built. I'm going to Immokalee and pick out a couple of Indians. And my fellow Titans, the Golden Gate Titans. I went to Olympus High and we were the Titans, the mighty Titans. So, Michelle, I was also vice president of the student body. Actually, I was the second vice president, which meant that I was in charge of the student council. So I'm glad to be here with my fellow vice president. And Caleb, I just want to say this. Where are you? Man, I had hair just like you. So enjoy it while you can. All right, so here's what I'm going to do. They told me to talk for about 30 minutes. I'm going to talk for about 15 minutes more, and then we'll answer questions. Because I want to start off on an interesting note. Look, we've been through a really ugly last couple of days. Talk about the proverbial shit show. And that's a scientific term, incidentally. We've been through it. Not very ennobling. Not ennobling for a party that I consider to be mine. And I hope some of you consider it to be yours. But more importantly, not ennobling for the country. This was not, okay, fine. There were some big important things here. Yeah, we ought to return to regular order. This idea that we cannot fund the largest enterprise in the world by passing 12 appropriations bills in a timely fashion so that we begin the fiscal year with a budget in place, and instead we bundle it all together 4 or 5 months into the year and do an omnibus is ridiculous. That is not good. You wouldn't practice that in your business. You wouldn't practice it in your household. Why do we practice it for our country? So there's some good things here. Return to regular order. But there was also a lot of stuff in here that was not helpful. I didn't believe that the Republican Party stood for affirmative action, for giving some people a special leg up. But apparently we do. Because all we got to do is get five knuckleheads out there to say, by God, we want more power, and we want more seats. We represent one out of every 11 Republicans, but we ought to get one out of every three seats on the all-important rules committee. That's not healthy. This is supposed to be about big things, and suddenly it turns out to be, I want to be Scott Perry. I don't want Jim Jordan to be in charge of the investigation of the Department of Justice. I want a special committee, and I get to be chairman of it. I'm Matt Gaetz, who's shown a proficiency at one thing since he went to Congress, and that's dating underaged women. Here's a guy who says, you know what? I want to be chairman of an important Armed Services subcommittee. I haven't shown one bit of inclination to being a serious legislator, but I want to have a gavel and a chairmanship. And that's not what this should be about. It should be about the government of our country and restoring people's confidence and trust in our government. But I want to start off by saying we got to contain our angst about this, because we've been screwed up before. We've been through multiple ballots before. Anybody remember Thomas Jefferson? What a guy. Author of the Declaration of Independence, wartime governor of Virginia, ambassador to France, vice president of the United States, who's elected president of the United States in 1800. Anybody remember the election of 1800? I wasn't around for it. Liddy may have been. I don't know. It ended in a tie in the Electoral College. You remember that? Ends in a tie in the Electoral College, necessitating a resolution of the presidential contest of 1800 by a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives. Back then, this is the first election which they ran as a ticket. But you're supposed to, they voted back then for the president, they voted for all the candidates, and the guy who got the largest number of votes was president. Number two was vice president. And the running mate for Thomas Jefferson was supposed to arrange for somebody in his New York delegation not to vote for him so that he come up number two, Aaron Burr. In fact, there's a letter written in November, just shortly before the Electoral College meets. Jefferson writes his son-in-law and says, some votes in Georgia will be cast for someone else. It's been arranged. And yet when the Electoral College meets, nobody from New York and nobody from Georgia throws away their vote. So there's a tie in the Electoral College, 73 votes for Jefferson, 73 votes for his running mate, Aaron Burr. And John Adams is third, and his running mate, Pinckney of South Carolina, is fourth. So it goes to the House of Representatives in February of 1801, February 11th. And in the time between December and February, a conspiracy arises to elect Aaron Burr president of the United States in lieu of his chief, Thomas Jefferson. So when the Congress meets in the middle of a blinding snowstorm on February 11th, they vote at noon, and it looks like it might go to Burr, except a Maryland congressman, who's thought to be dying by his wife, insists upon being carried on a stretcher 2 miles through the snow-filled streets of Washington, D.C., to be installed in a committee room next to the House floor so that he can deadlock Maryland and keep the election from going to Aaron Burr. This happens at noon. They decide they're going to vote every hour on the hour until they can break the tie. Because nobody's got the nine, there are 16 states, have to have nine of them behind you, and nobody has a majority. And they vote every hour on the hour for the next 24 hours. Remember when we saw them the other day voting? They vote 23 times. Every hour on the hour. And every time they vote, it's indeterminate. So on the second day, they say, you know what, let's slow this sucker up. Let's figure out if we can find a way out of this. And they end up voting to 34 times. And on the 17th of February, on the 35th vote, the deadlock breaks because of the unlikely intervention of somebody. Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton has written a letter to George Baird, the Federalist Congressman from Delaware, and he says, I hate him. I hate them both. But at least Jefferson has character, and Burr has none. And given a choice of two evils, take the lesser every time. And on the 35th ballot, on February 17th, 1801, Thomas Jefferson is elected President of the United States and is sworn into office 15 days later. Remember the 34 days from hell in Florida 2000? Think about December, January, February, and the president being sworn in 15 days after he was elected. So we've been screwed up before. We have. As a country, our politics has been broken. It's been broken in our lifetimes. Anybody here remember 1968? Anybody remember 1972? The assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968, and within 24 hours, 147 American cities are ablaze. We were in an era where there were deep conflicts in our country over an unpopular war in Southeast Asia and over the question of equality for every American, regardless of their race, creed, or color. And our country looked like it was falling apart. We had an explicit racist running for president in 1968 and 1972 and garnering the votes of states all across the South and winning primaries in the North. George Corley Wallace. Looked like the country was coming apart. Kids are being killed on campuses. We have one president who was driven from office for fear of being defeated, Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1968, and another president who left office because he was going to be impeached, August 1974, Richard Nixon. You don't think politics was broken? You don't think our country looked like it was coming apart? It was. Think about the 30s. One out of every four Americans is without a job. And we have the growth of populism on the left and the right. Father Coughlin on the right with a gigantic radio station broadcasting out of Detroit. And Huey Long, every man a king. Country was divided. We have the 1840s and the 1850s. We all studied it in school. We remember we remember about Senator Sumner of Massachusetts being caned by the congressman from South Carolina. But there's a brilliant new book out by a woman named Joanne Freeman, a great historian, in which she goes through the evidence to show that in the 1840s and 1850s, it was routine for members of Congress to carry weapons onto the floor of the House of Representatives. And violence was frequent. Sumner is not the only one. He was just the worst. Bill was kind enough to mention my book, The Triumph of William McKinley. I strongly recommend it to you. It's a hell of a read. It's got sex, violence, backstabbing, betrayal, twists and turns worthy of a coked up Hollywood screenwriter, and really cool nicknames. We've got to bring back the cool nickname thing. The Republican presidential candidate is the Napoleon of protection. And the Democratic nominee is the boy orator of the Platte. The Republican nominee is selected by beating the Combine, the Republican bosses. That's the name of their group, the Combine. They're led by the easy boss, Senator Thomas Collier Platt of New York. One of his chief lieutenants is the blonde boss, 32-year-old Chicago Congressman William Larimer, who has 20,000 patronage jobs at his disposal. And the Democratic front runner, who's beaten by William Jennings Bryan, is Richard Park Bland of Lebanon, Missouri, who for 20 years has led the fight for the free and unlimited coinage of silver, a cause he calls the cause of humanity itself. And his nickname is Silver Dick. Anyway. And the politics of this Gilded Age is broken. You think today is bad? Go back to the Gilded Age. We have 25 years during which there are five presidential elections and nobody gets 50% of the vote. We have 2 years with a Republican president, House and Senate, 2 years with a Democratic president, House and Senate, and 20 years of divided government where virtually nothing gets done because the men who represent the nation in the halls of Congress hate each other's guts. They're still fighting the Civil War. When the Democrats take control of the House in 1874 for the first time in 18 years. It's called The Victory of the Brigadiers, because so many former Confederate officers have now been elected to Congress. Remember back in 1984, some of you may remember, the Bloody Eighth of Indiana. There was an Indiana congressional district where a Republican wins election by 34 votes in a highly contested race. And it goes to the floor of the House of Representatives, and then Speaker Jim Wright objects to the election of the Republicans, puts in place a committee that investigates it, and after a while votes, proposes to the House, and on a straight party line vote, the House of Representatives kicks out the Republican who was elected and replaces him with his Democrat opponent, and it poisoned the well for much of the next decade in the House of Congress. In the Gilded Age, guess how many times between 1875 and 1902, the majority party in the House, which vibrates back and forth between Republicans and Democrats, phonies up an election challenge to a member of the minority who won re-election by a small number of votes and kicks him out. Guess how many times? 55. In fact, in 1884, the future president of the United States, William McKinley, who'd won re-election legally by 50 votes, is kicked out of the House of Representatives by the Democratic majority in order to grow their numbers. And the only unusual thing about it is that seven Democrat members, including the former Democrat Speaker of the House, vote to retain McKinley as a mark of respect. This finally, the fever is finally broken in 1902, when a Colorado Democrat is being challenged for election, and a special committee is investigating him, and he pays careful attention to it. And on the day the committee makes its report, he stands up and says, "I have listened carefully and examined the evidence, and it is now apparent to me that my election was tainted by fraud perpetuated by members of my own party. I ask you to join with me in voting to expel me from the House of Representatives and replace me with my Republican opponent who was duly elected by the people of my district." He was elected governor 2 years later on the slogan of Honest John. But that's what it took to break it. And you cannot believe how ugly the politics of the time is. I mean, you remember we had that kerfluffle a couple years ago? We're going to shut down the government unless we repeal Obamacare. Obama has to agree to repeal Obamacare, or we're going to shut down the government. That lasted a lot of, you know, that was very useful. In 1888, the Republicans take the White House, the House, and the Senate. And in the House of Representatives, they've got a narrow margin. And the Democrats announced in the fall of 18, back then they were civilized. They would, this is before Rooney air-conditioned America. So they would swear you in March and then send you home until November because there's no air conditioning in Washington. And so everybody shows up in November of 1889. And the Democrats announced they will not allow a single bill to be passed through the House of Representatives. They will refuse to answer the roll call and deny the House a quorum. So you'll have a vote. The Democrats will say a quorum is not present. They'll call the roll. No Democrat answers the roll call, denies the House a quorum, and they move on. November and December of 1889, nothing happens in the House of Representatives. And in early January, the Speaker of the House, Thomas Brackett Reed of Maine, decides, "I've had enough of this." So he says, "Okay, we're going to have a vote. And it's on expelling a West Virginia Democrat who won re-election by about 50 votes and replacing him with his Republican opponent. And when I call the vote, you, Sergeant-at-Arms, take up station at each one of the doors of the House chamber, lock arms, and allow no member to leave." Going to have another group of Sergeant-at-Arms who are going to get planks and put them through the handles of the doors outside so that nobody can push their way out. They have the vote. They move to expel the member. The Republicans narrowly prevail. A gentleman from Kentucky stands up and says, "I believe there is not a quorum present." And they call the roll. Not a single Democrat answers the roll. At which point, Reed turns to the clerk and says, "The chair directs the clerk to show Mr. Jones present, Mr. Smith present, Mr. Fall present, Mr. Winter present," calls out the name of every Democrat on the floor of the House. What happens? All hell breaks loose. Every Democrat heads for the doors. One gets out. Constantine August of Rusk County, Texas, beats the crap out of the Sergeant-at-Arms and uses his cowboy boots to kick out the slats of the door and make good his escape. The guy who called for the roll call stands up and screams at Reed, "Under God and the Constitution, you have no right to count me present without my permission." To which Reed says, "The Honorable Gentleman from Kentucky, is the Honorable Gentleman from Kentucky present upon the floor of the House or not?" This kicks off a two-month-long battle that ends up in the U.S. Supreme Court as to whether or not the Speaker of the House has a right to do this. It's ultimately resolved that he does. But in the meantime, for nearly 5 months, not a single bill is passed through the House of Representatives. No post office is renamed, no budget is passed, no legislation makes it through the House and through to the Senate and the President. They have a debate the next day after this happens. Contributing to the tone of the times, a Texan stands up, William Henry Hattie Martin of Athens, Texas, 6'6" tall, thin as a rail, mean as a snake, stands up and says to his fellow Democrats, pointing a bony finger at Reed, he says, if any member will order me to remove this dictator from his position of power upon the podium, I will do so by force forthwith. Reed says, the honorable gentleman from Texas is out of order, and moves on. Martin is so pissed off. The next day he comes and takes a seat right in front of the speaker where Liddy is sitting, pulls out his 16-inch long Bowie knife and spends the entire session sharpening it on his boot sole in an attempt to menace the Speaker of the House. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I didn't see Nancy Pelosi doing that with her stilettos the other night when she was forced to give up power. Just don't. My point is this, we're broken. We are broken as a country, our politics is. But it's not new. The system is built in such a way, constructed by our founders in such a way, that they anticipated that human beings would make mistakes and that we would have failings like these moments. That's the beauty of the Constitution. But the moment is coming when the good common sense of the American people will reassert itself as it has before. And that good common sense will say, enough. Get your act together and do things mostly right, and try and get along and put the country first. And that moment is coming, sooner rather than later. With that, let's go to your questions. I'll answer or duck them as I see fit.
Carl, thank you. All right, some questions. First one, you're widely regarded as a master of messaging. What are the key characteristics of a message that would capture the hearts and minds and lead to positive change?
Yeah, that's interesting. I teach a class at the University of Texas at Austin. It actually starts today. We were supposed to meet today. We're meeting Wednesday. We meet Mondays and Wednesdays, so I'm missing my first class today in order to be with you here today. I didn't know that I was gonna miss the class when I accepted the invitation because I hadn't agreed to teach the class again until this semester, but anyway. But this is one of the questions we're going to deal with. Each week is devoted to a subject, and our first one is organization, and two of my students are interviewing a guy you may have heard of about how to organize a presidential campaign, a guy named James A. Baker III. That'll be next Monday. The week after will be messaging, and two of my students will interview David Axelrod, Barack Obama's chief messenger. My view is that the country is desperate for somebody who says, I have an optimistic and positive view of what the future can be. And I'm younger, I'm energetic, I'm inclusive. I recognize that not everybody's gonna agree with me all of the time, but I'm a sunny optimist who thinks we can find common ground and I'm gonna take on the big challenges the country faces. I think the country's, it's 1959 or 1960. Think about this. Dwight D. Eisenhower is president of the United States, an admirable figure, born in the 19th century. He'd served our country in World War I, obviously served our country in World War II, had been a good president. But the country said, thank you so much, but we really want one of these young guys, these 40-year-olds, who saved the world in the what we now call the greatest generation. But remember, they were punks. Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, both in their mid-40s, early 40s, fought the war, and the country said, we want to say thank you, people who were born in the 19th century, but we want the kids who were born in the 1920s. And for 32 years thereafter, from 1960 to 1982, our presidents were members of the greatest generation, ending with George H.W. And then we elected a baby boomer. And for 32 years, we have been led by somebody from the baby boomer generation. Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden. Biden is actually from the generation before the baby boomers, the so-called silent generation. But I'm looking at this. I'm looking at this, saying, "Look, I know what it is." Francis knows what he was in and out of the White House. Liddy was in and out of the White House. This is a terrible job. There's a reason why every occupant of that office ages, because their responsibilities are enormous. And the challenges we face as a country, frankly, need somebody with energy and ability. And the 78-year-old and the 82-year-old aren't going to cut it. So I think we're likely to find...
This is a related question. How do we get back to agreeing and disagreeing and maintaining civility?
Kill the social media experts. I have no real idea how to do this, because it's just, and again, it's not like this is new. We go through these moments where we don't seem to be able to get along as a country, and our politicians seem to be ugly with each other, and they don't seem to be able to talk to each other. And yet, as Francis could tell you, having served there, I mean, these are men and women who, by and large, yeah, they're the Matt Gaetz of the world, who want to, you know, I want to be a cable TV star. But most of these people did not come to Washington in order to engage in food fights and say ugly things about each other. They don't mark their days as successful because they got on cable TV. They came there to do something for the country. But they have to have leaders who clear out the underbrush and make it possible for them to act. And I don't want to be overly critical of our current president, but it was a mistake. Think about this. I was reading this morning in the paper. Do you know when the governor of the state of Texas was told, "We want you to come to El Paso and meet the president"? Yesterday. 24, on the eve of the day before, excuse me, not yesterday, Saturday night for a Sunday morning arrival. That's not good. That's not just bad staff work. That is deliberate. That's a deliberate signal of you know what? We don't care how this border crisis is impacting your state. You know, we don't care. And that's not what a president needs to do. And that's not what our leaders need to do in the Congress. We really do need to. I'm sort of, one of the things I like about McCarthy is that about a year and a half, I've sort of figured out he really does mean it when he says return to regular order. And that means empowering these committee chairs. And that means that you're going to have committee chairs and ranking members sitting in the same room. There's just a natural tendency, if people are talked to each other as human beings, for them to try and find common ground. And it won't be on a lot of things, but it's you're already starting to see it. Think about last year. Infrastructure bill, China bill, those didn't come from the White House. Those came from members of Congress saying, "We're sick and tired of what's going on. Can't we find some common agreement here? We got to reauthorize the Highway Trust Fund every 5 years." So the House comes out with a stupid proposal that says no money appropriated under this act may be used to increase any capacity on any existing federal interstate highway or to create any new mile of any new interstate highway. And the Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans on transportation say, "That's nutty, can't we do better?" And out of it comes the infrastructure bill. A freshman Republican senator from Indiana is deeply concerned about us being dependent upon semiconductors that are being made in foundries on the island of Taiwan, thereby putting the entire modern economy of America at risk in the event of a Chinese invasion of that island. And he finds out he's got somebody else who's thinking the same way, who's a senior Democrat from Virginia, Mark Warner. So Todd Young and Mark Warner get together and say, "What can we come up with as a way to strengthen the economic security of our country by doing something to give a jolt to the semiconductor industry so that we got more foundries here and less dependent upon foundries on that island located 90 miles off of the coast of China?" That's happening. And I think if we have good leadership in the House and Senate that recognize that, then maybe we will get back to what we need to be.
This next question is from Sarah Rant. Sarah, where are you? Back there. Do you believe the Supreme Court will allow state legislators to choose the electors?
No. The Constitution says that it's the states determine the manner and time of elections, and states have laws on the books. And no. Now, this is bound up in a esoteric legal debate over whether or not states have the right to determine those laws. And I do think the court is going to say that they have the right, you know, to set the rules regarding how you draw district lines and how you do you have voter ID or not. But they're not going to say states have a right to overturn the popular will of the American people. And if they did, Katie, bar the door.
I'm interested in the answer to this one in particular. Who should run the RNC? Let's see if we get an answer on this one. Who should run the RNC?
I wish I could say somebody different than somebody that we got, but no. Look, we got two choices. One of them is Ronna Romney, who is the current chairman, who has had a lot to deal with. It is not easy to deal with Donald J. Trump. It is not easy to say, no, we shouldn't be paying your legal bills, and we shouldn't be hiring the people you want us to hire, and we ought to focus on trying to win elections rather than refighting the last election. And it's been, I suspect, a deeply personal fight for her, because I know how roughly she's been treated in some instances. And the woman who's running against her is a nice person, an accomplished election lawyer. But I got a funny view about this. Hermeet Dillon has been paid $1.3 million to do legal work for the Republican National Committee. I don't think members of the Republican National Committee should be on the payroll of the Republican National Committee. I think that's a bad practice. I hold Ronna responsible for it, but I also hold Dharmeet responsible for it. And I've done a little background checking on her. She has no involvement in California retail politics. She's not been the chairman of a congressional committee. She's not been on a campaign committee. She's not been a fundraiser. She's basically an election lawyer. And the people that are surrounding her are people that make me nervous. The first state chairman to endorse her was Kelly Ward of Arizona, who's a complete lunatic. She's now been endorsed by our state chairman in Texas, Matt Rinaldi, who is even worse lunatic. You just don't know about him. Every couple of days, he attacks the sitting Republican governor of the state of Texas, and the sitting Republican lieutenant governor, and the sitting Republican speaker, every couple of days. Here was an institution that did little to be involved in the elections last year, and yet is spending money to bus people to come to Austin to protest the practice in our legislature of some 50 years of not organizing on a partisan basis. You may not know that about Texas. Politics is a blood sport in Texas until our legislature begins to meet in January of every other year. We're the second most populous state in the union, and then our legislature meets for 140 days every 2 years. And there are Republican majorities in both houses, and there are Democratic committee chairs. Just like when the Democrats were in a huge majority, there were Republican committee chairs. We try and remove the politics where possible, and let people be focused on what's the best thing to do for the state. So you may remember back in the fiscal year, back when Liddy was trying to save AIG and did, and we were all of our state budgets were in turmoil. Texas had to cut its biennial budget by $10 billion. And I don't mean cut the future growth of the spending. I mean cut it from its current level by $10 billion for the next 2 years. And that passed the Texas House 147-3. Because Republicans and Democrats got together and said, we're in a tight place. We have to have a balanced budget. What do we do to get our house in order? And they did it together. But our state party chairman is now supporting Dillon. Why? Because she is of, you know, whatever she has said to him makes it attractive to him, a guy who wants to blow up that kind of great advantage that our state has. So I'm reluctantly for Ronna. I'd rather try and have Ronna fix what needs to be fixed than to try and convince somebody who's drawing support from these kind of lunatics. And I do mean lunatics. This guy, Matt Rinaldi, we had a deeply divisive argument about sanctuary cities, which to me are just, you know, horrendous public policy. And we had a state law that would outlaw sanctuary cities in Texas, which we did. But during the debate, the chamber was filled with Hispanic Texans. And Rinaldi stood up and said, pointed to the galleries and said that he was going to call the INS and the Border Patrol to come and arrest all these illegals. He then nearly got in a fist fight in a parking garage with a Democrat member who took offense at that, an Hispanic member from the Rio Grande Valley. And in the next election, in a solidly Republican district in North Dallas, Matt Rinaldi was defeated by 14 points. This is a guy now who says, I want to go with this gal for Republican National Chairman. And wherever he goes, I goeth not.
What two issues will the 2024 presidential election turn on?
You know what? I don't know. And I don't know because we got several geological ages that are going to come and go between now and 2024. The Jurassic, the Paleozoic, the Mesozoic. Clearly, the economy traditionally is one of the big issues, and I think it will remain a big issue. Because I'm one of these skeptics who thinks that they aren't. We're making progress on getting inflation out of the system, but it's easy to get it in. It's harder to get it out. And I do think the question of competence is going to be there, because if the Democrats make the mistake of nominating Biden, which I don't think they will. But let's assume for a minute they do. People are going to be sitting there saying, really? 82? You serve a full term, you're going to be closer to 90 than to 80? And your running mate is her? I mean, his numbers are bad. Hers are worse for good reason. And so I think the question of competence, people will be saying, are you capable of leading our country and making decisions? And then the big thing is going to be what the world looks like. Whether Ukraine, and I do believe we're still likely to find Russia in Ukraine, and I think we're likely to see if things go south in Ukraine, which I don't think they will, but we're likely to see the North Koreans and the Chinese and the Iranians trying to take advantage of any moment of weakness they see in us. But it's, you know, this is why presidential elections are so important and why this year is so critical for our party. People say, well, who's our best candidate? I don't know. And guess what? They don't either. They don't. Because none of them is prepared for what's about ready to happen to them. None of them. Think about this. George W. Bush takes 2 years out of his life and in 1987 and 1988 moves to Washington, D.C. and plays a critical role in his father's re-election father's election campaign. Literally sitting there in the headquarters every single day for 2 years. Comes back to Texas and 6 years later runs for governor in a huge state. Second most populous state, but the second biggest physical state in the union. Beats a woman who's a favorable rating on election day, Ann Richards, is 62%, by running a disciplined, focused campaign on four big issues. Runs for re-election 2 years later as only the second Republican in 120 years to be the governor of the state of Texas. Runs for re-election and wins two-thirds of the vote, including 50% of the Hispanic vote. And we don't have a lot of Cubans. We got Theodore Cruz and a couple of his family members, but that's about it. And wins re-election. And then is the front runner in 1999, declares in June. And I remember sitting in Iowa about 3 months later when he turned around and said, you know what? This is bigger, more complicated, and more challenging than I could ever have imagined. Well, here was the guy who had every right to imagine because he's been in the middle of it. And that's what every one of these people is going to do. They're going to go out there, and this is why it's important to get them out there, maybe not as formal candidates, but to get them out there coming to the Forum Club and moving around the country and trying to articulate a message, because they are either going to get good and better or they aren't. I don't want to have a big field of 17 people who emerge late in the year. I don't want to have, you know, people who aren't out there trying to come to some understanding of what your message is and how they ought to be and who they ought to be talking to and how they ought to be, who are the people they gather around them to help advise them. I mean, that's all important. But and how they handle that, those initial tasks are going to be critical in determining who's going to, by the end of the year, be part of that, I think, relatively small group of people who are out there as candidates for us. Because I think, I don't know about you, but I want to win. And I sense from a lot of people, they want to win. And we know that the key to winning is not to have 17 people running in a food fight for 5 or 6 months. And so we want to get them out there, maybe not as official candidates just yet, but we want to get them out there. February 24th, we're going to have an event in Austin to reward the donors to a voter registration effort. And we have invited a variety of people. 2 years ago, we had the same event. We had at that event, in alphabetical order, Chris Christie, Ron DeSantis, Mike Pence, Mike Pompeo, Marco Rubio, Rick Scott, and Tim Scott. Nikki Haley wanted to come, but she had a daughter graduating from nursing school that day. We've invited all of those people, plus others. Sununu, Kemp have both accepted. We hope your governor comes. But we'll have 500 people in the room, all of whom supported the voter registration effort or played a key role in it. And we each one is interviewed for 45 minutes by a member of the Texas congressional delegation. 2 years ago, it was the best political event I had been to in my life. It was unbelievable. Dan Crenshaw interviewed your governor and gave him a personality. By starting 150 miles away from where you thought he would start, opening question was, Yale? You went to Yale? How did that happen? It was 22 minutes before they got around to being governor of Florida. Tim Scott started off why you might expect, being interviewed by Kevin Brady, chairman of Ways and Means Committee. We worked together, didn't we, on the 2017 tax bill, and you were the big exponent of opportunity zones. Let's talk about those for a couple minutes. After 4 or 5 minutes talking about opportunity zones, which is really an exciting subject, Kevin said, okay, we've exhausted that. I want to now make this a little bit more personal. You don't know what I'm going to ask you. We haven't talked about this. I hope you won't take offense, but I want people to know you like I know you. They're members of the same men's Bible study class. And he says to Tim, Tim, when was the first moment that you knew that somebody hated you because of the color of your skin? And when it was so riveting. I mean, he was talking about who he was and how he'd come to life and how he'd ended up where he was. It was incredibly powerful. But, you know, we got to get him out there, and we got to give him opportunities like that to either get better or not, because we need him to be better.
Let's see if we're doing on timer. One more question. What do you think Donald Trump will do during the process here? How is he going to try to influence the process? And if he does not get the Republican nomination, what's he going to do?
Yeah, well, good luck on getting a good answer on that. Look, I don't know the guy. I've been around him some very strange moments. Carl. I go into the Oval Office. So I get this call. We're off the record, right? No press. So I get this call in May of 2020, a lovely time, as you remember. And one of his key advisors says, what do you think of the theory that we can't attack Biden because if we attack him too much, the Obama people will remove him as a Democratic candidate, and they'll put Andrew Cuomo in there, and Michelle Obama will be his running mate, and we can beat him, but it'll be a lot tougher, so we better lay off him. What do you think of that theory? And I said, it's incredibly insane. Well, whoever's peddling that is a lunatic. And next night, I get another call from another advisor, same conversation. I said, yeah, some lunatic is obviously talking to the president. So on Thursday night, I get a call from Parscale, who says, act surprised, but Molly Michaels is going to call you on Saturday morning and invite you to have lunch on Wednesday with the president, who wants to talk about this theory with you. So I say, sure, that's going to happen. So Saturday morning, 9 o'clock, Molly Michaels calls. President would like to see you Wednesday. Can you come? My wife says, it's COVID. You're not getting on an airliner. Fortunately, she has a 94-year-old godfather who's the largest highway contractor in Texas, Doug Pitcock. And Doug has like a fleet of planes, so I borrow the Hawker and he flies me to Washington. I walk in the Oval and Trump says, everybody know Carl? First of all, there are 15 people in the Oval. 15 people. I mean, I was in the Oval like several times every day, and I don't remember a meeting with 15 people. Everybody know Carl? Hope, you know Carl? You know Jared? You know Ivanka? Hey, Carl, he's been so good to me the last 6 months. Before that, not so good. So, I don't know what the guy, I mean, we ended up spending 3 hours. And he ended up understanding that that was a lunatic theory. Oh, this is so smart. Are you listening, Rana? Are you listening? Why are people not telling me these things? Really? The Obama people don't like the Biden people? I didn't know that. Okay. They're losers. So anyway, look, first of all, I don't know what he's going to do. I do know this. The message of the election was stolen from me is not enough to win the nomination, and certainly not enough to win the general election. That's looking in the rearview mirror. I travel a lot, and even without the whiteboard, people come up to me and, hey, are you Karl Rove? last night this woman says, you look just like Carl Rove. I said, I get that all the time. I said, she said, I'm sorry, I hope you don't take offense. And I decided, I'm not going to say I'm Carl Rove. But, you know, people come up to me and they say, I love what he did. He did so many good things. I love the judges. I love this. I adored Aaron. But, you know, it's time to turn the page. I hope he doesn't run. He's running. But my sense is that people are looking to what's next, not the rearview mirror. Now, what can he do if he doesn't win the nomination? First of all, he can't run as an independent. After Ross Perot did that in 92 and 96, state laws were changed to make it more difficult to get on the ballot as an independent candidate. Evan McMullen, remember him, who ran against the president? He got votes in 34 states. So he's not even on the ballot in 17 states. We got the District of Columbia, makes it 51. Of the 34, he was on the ballot in only 23. The others were write-in votes. So I don't think the former president, if he doesn't receive the nomination, is going to try and go independent, because it's too late to get on all 50 state ballots, and you're guaranteed to be a loser. And if there's one thing he doesn't want to be, he does not want to be the guy who comes in third. Now, I could see him say, not treated fairly, and tell his people not to vote, which will hurt. Take a look at Georgia, January of 2021. Take the 159 counties in Georgia and rank them by the percentage of the Trump vote. Take the 159 counties and rank them by the percentage drop-off in the vote, the turnout between November and January. And it's an almost one-to-one relationship. That is to say, the bigger the Trump number, the bigger the drop-off between November and January. And why? Because he told people, your vote doesn't count. And people said, he told me it didn't count. I'm not going to bother to turn out. And we lose. Now, the other reason we lose is because he came in Sunday night just before the election. You may not know this, but did you know there were three elections that day in Georgia? Two for the U.S. Senate, and one for the Public Service Commission. And Lauren S. Bubba McDonald Jr., Republican, won the Public Service Commission race with 23,000 votes more than David Perdue and nearly 35,000 votes more than Kelly Loeffler. Those were Republican-leaning voters, or Republicans, who said, I'm not voting for anybody connected with that guy, but I am going to turn out and vote for Lauren S. Bubba McDonald Jr. for the Public Service Commission, whatever the hell that is. Incidentally, there was Lauren S. Bubba McDonald, who was a conservative Democrat who became a Republican. There is his son, Lauren S. Bubba McDonald Jr., who's now the Public Service Commissioner. And Lauren S. Bubba McDonald III is now holding his father's state representative seat, which was once held by his grandfather. So they got a lot of Bubbas all in one area in Georgia. Anyway, thanks for having me here today. Thank you. Thank you.